Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, still hosting without the help of Jeremy Goldkorn. Jeremy is still in New Zealand this week. So with two literary festivals going on right now in Beijing, the Bookworm Literary Festival and the Capital Literary Festival at Capital M, we thought it would be a good time to do a literary-themed podcast, and what better topic than the first PRC national to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, Mo Yan. Now, when the award was announced in October of last year, everyone seemed to have an opinion, whether they were familiar with his work or not. So Ai Weiwei, of course, was quick out the gates to condemn the Nobel Committee's decision as a catastrophe. The 2009 winner, Herta Mueller, said the same thing, basically. And then Perry Link, who's a very well-known scholar of Chinese literature, as well as the author Salman Rushdie, they both lined up on the sort of anti-Mo side of the emerging debate, and a number of others rode to Mo Yan's defense, including Charles Laughlin, Rebecca Liao, and Pankaj Mishra, who's actually been on the show before. We've got three guests today, any one of whom has forgotten much more about contemporary Chinese literature than I've ever known. So we'll be talking about Mo Yan's oeuvre, his prose style, and of course, the by now familiar controversy surrounding his award. So first up, we have Alice Xin Liu, who is managing editor of Pathlight, which we've discussed before on the show. It's a literary magazine with translations of contemporary Chinese fiction. And she's also a colleague of Jeremy's over at Danwei.com. Welcome back, Alice.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Also with us today is Brendan O'Kane, whose voice might be familiar to pop-up Chinese subscribers. Brendan's a respected translator who's been working in China now for over a decade and has many translation and subtitle credits to his name. Great to have you on Cynica, Brendan.
Howdy.
And finally, we're also joined by Cynica regular David Moser, who is director of Chinese studies at CET in Beijing, and he's a longtime China watcher and an awesome pianist. How's it going, David?
Great. Good to be here again.
So let's jump right in. I think what we're going to do first is treat people to something very special here. We have an issue of the newest issue of Pathlight before us right now, actually, in our clammy little hands. And it features the first short story to be published since Mo Yan's Nobel Prize was awarded, and it's called
A Date with the Master.
A Date with the Master. And we're going to hear a couple of paragraphs from that read by our Alice.
In her dulcet tones.
Indeed.
Alluring. Okay, so A Date with the Master by Mo Yan, translated by Harold Goldblatt. 1. We were a long time elbowing our way through the crowd at the art exhibit the whole city was talking about before we finally made it up to where the master was standing. Our hearts pounded with such excitement we were barely able to stammer out our heartfelt, if incoherent, reverence for his work. With his sweat-soaked little hand, he shook the sweaty palms of his nervous, totally psyched admirers, and the impression the handshake made on us would last a lifetime. But it wasn't nearly as powerful as the warm, welcoming smile he bestowed upon us. When we asked him for his phone number, our voices quivering with excitement, he graciously passed out business cards. Since a long line of admirers had fanned out behind us, the master said cordially, "The room is too noisy, my friends, too chaotic. We'll have a nice chat in a quieter place one day soon." We were struck by the feeling that a special bond had been formed between the master and us. Reluctantly, he was asking us to give up our spot to let those behind us come up. It was a public event, after all. He had no choice, so he saw us off with an apologetic nod, and we understood why. The moment we relaxed, we were actually shunted out of the way by the surge of the crowd behind us. And before we knew it, we were all the way in the rear. The night after we'd seen everything there was to see at the exhibit, we dialed the master's number. What we heard was a courteous computerized message. "We're sorry, the number you dialed is not in service." Sure, we were disappointed, but not even close to giving up. Next, he dialed the cell phone number he'd given us. Once again, a courteous digitized voice said, "We're sorry, the number you dialed is outside the service area." So we tried again, and this time the voice said, "We're sorry, but the party has turned off his phone." Both of these messages, "outside the service area" and "has turned off his phone," were comforting words, proof that the master had given us real numbers, or at the very least, a number that was in service. Having failed to reach his cell phone, we tried his pager. In a sweet, languid voice, the answering machine operator invited us to leave a message. A brief exchange of looks produced a consensus message. "Master, as your devoted worshippers, we would like to invite you for a coffee and a chance to tell you how we felt about your exhibit. Please get back to us and fulfill the desires of your young admirers."
Okay, so it's intriguing. I'm intrigued. Who is this master, and who are these little toadying sycophants who are...
If it weren't...
I don't know, but they're on Dobar.
If it weren't Chinese, I would think it was a different version of Waiting for Godot.
Right, yeah. I mean,
that's the feeling it has.
Alice, right? Tell us about what happens in this story and what is your interpretation of what it means and its ultimate significance.
Well, after massacring the reading, I'm actually really a big fan of this story because it's from the late period of Mo Yan, so I think 2005 onwards. It's a recent story, and it's actually very satirical. It's basically what Mo Yan is known for, in my books anyway, which is satire. So the young fans who I've just introduced are sort of like a multitude. It represents a multitude of people who are all hankering after some sort of spiritual delight, I guess, in their lives. And the master, you know, is a very contentious figure in Chinese society right now because you have so many people having art exhibits but no real art to speak of. And you also have people like Ai Weiwei who produces like supposedly amazing art and is all over the newspapers, at least I guess abroad, but also to an extent in China. But really, what is the substance of that? So really, I mean, the master is sort of a very esoteric sense in this story, but it's very satirical towards the end.
So he's going after that sort of emperor's new clothes phenomenon of as a sort of worship of people who are entirely made of sort of style and absent substance.
Right. He also goes into kind of Mo Yan's very good at writing out poetry, like mock poetry. I think he wrote one about Bo Xilai, which is quoted in the Der Spiegel article recently. Mm-hmm. So he makes up poets later on in the story whose poetry is so bad. And, you know, they use phrases like flounder's anus, you know, and rhymes with it. And, you know, it's great and it's so entertaining. But basically, he's sort of critiquing this phenomenon of anyone can becoming a poet. Anyone who can get into the crowd, be like a liumang and go and sleep with your friend's girlfriend can become a poet. And then they can go somewhere else like Beijing and try and make themselves even bigger, which I actually sometimes wonder if he's criticizing, you know, the Ai Weiwei phenomenon in a way.
Well, Weiwei certainly wasn't generous to him after his Nobel Prize was announced.
And no.
This story was written actually...
Before.
Okay. It was written before, but only published after.
Published in English after.
Yeah. Okay, great. Really looking forward to reading it. Can't wait to get home and dig into that. Is this sort of a typical style, Brendan, of Mo Yan's approach, acerbic, satirical?
Acerbic, satirical. His novels tend not to be set in urban settings.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be a lot more common, kind of working, a lot more comfortable, rather, working with stuff that he's drawn from his own experience. But in terms of satire, he, like a lot of writers of his generation, he creates these situations which are freakishly and often unpleasantly distorted versions of realistic situations, whether in this case with, you know, sycophantic little toadies with no taste, in some of his novels with corrupt officials, with venal villagers, you name it. He's not so concerned with realism as he is with this impressionistic distortion, funhouse mirror version of reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How is it that Perry Link characterized it?
Daft hilarity.
Do you think that's a fair characterization of is it sort of this cleverly turned kind of...
You mean what Perry Link?
Sense. Yeah, the hilarity bit. I mean, like, for example, he's in Link's now well-known piece in the New York Review of Books. He talks about how in a sweeping overview of Chinese history, he comes to the three bad years and he's talking about events taking place during the famine. But rather than discussing the fact of starvation and cannibalism and whatnot, as is now you're obliged to do apparently, he instead sort of makes a joke and has everyone laughing.
I mean, a lot of his stuff to me seems to be quite realistic. I mean, I know it's kind of magical realism, it's out of the blue, and it's turned people into animals and speaks from the mouth of like the Mother Earth, supposedly, and all this stuff. But I mean, and he turns things kind of into a funny little anecdote. But I actually think that this is the language that he used when he was in Gaomi, in, you know, the township he's from in Shandong in Gaomi. So all of this kind of, there's lots of swearing, foul-mouthed, uneducated people, women especially, you know, and, you know, they're all talking, and every single sentence they utter is full of kind of
the Rabelaisian bodiness.
Yeah, you know, the women's parts and pig's parts. And I mean, it's all very realistic to me. I don't know if I'm a fan of it. You know, I'm not, I can't, aesthetically, we can have a different conversation, but the realism, you know, to me is very authentic.
I have a question, because when I'm hearing that, and, you know, Moyan has been compared to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, mm-hmm. with this mm-hmm. South American, what they call magical realism, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as someone who, you know, reads lots of Chinese fiction and stuff, immediately I'm thinking, how is this reflecting Chinese society? I mean, you're wondering, you know, is this a critique of Chinese society? Whereas when I read Marquez and some of the other South American writers,
you feel there's more universal.
Yeah, although it's embedded in that South American culture. It's clearly, I mean, the names mm-hmm. and everything, but you don't think immediately, is this telling us something about, you know,
well,
you know,
I mean,
South American culture? You just think this, he's speaking about universal human issues. Is that wrong? I mean, is this? I mean, I haven't read the story yet.
Right.
But is it about China?
Yes. I mean, this story is different because I think it's set in a city. So I can imagine it being at the National Art Museum in Meishuguan in Beijing. And these crowds are actually outside the Meishuguan. And then they meet the master in the bar, which, you know, is very urbanized. But most of the Moyan oeuvre is set in Gaomi, and it's about the Chinese peasants from the imperialist times, the Japanese war, you know, anti-Japanese war, all the way to reform and opening up, and it's set in the countryside. And that's probably the experience of most Chinese people, not including myself and others I know in the city.
So let's talk a little bit about Moore himself. I mean, as a person, his own his background. When was he born? In what circumstances did he grow up? I know that his career was mainly in the PLA, right? And when did he really begin publishing fiction? And if there's sort of a trajectory that we can trace in his prose style. Brandon, maybe you want to take a crack at that?
First off, when you say his career was in the PLA, that's misleading.
Okay.
Like, say, Yan Liangke, I mean, he was affiliated with the PLA's Literature Academy. And this, of course, blows people's minds that the People's Liberation Army would have a literary academy. It does.
Right.
It's called the Luoxun Institute.
No, it's the PLA Art Academy.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
And PLA. He later went on to the Luoxun Institute at Beishida, normal university, right?
Yeah, but a lot of people anyway who are not employed in the army go through this thing.
Yeah.
Basically, take a stipend from the government to read modernist literature and then mm-hmm. come out having refined their technique.
Right.
Mo did it. Yan Liangke, who maybe we can talk about later as kind of a minimal pair, also did it.
Yeah, so I have a quick rundown. Brendan and I discussed this in the week. I'm going to take this, but it's very brief. 1981, he begins publishing short stories. 86, writes Red Sorghum, which makes his fame when it's made into a film in 1988.
Directed by
Zhang Yimou. Yeah, starring Gong Li and Jiang Wen. So that's huge, wins international awards. Mo Yan becomes very famous. And then he publishes the works that we know about, Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out, Big Breasts and Wide Hips, Sandalwood Death, which is recently translated, and 2009 was the latest, Frogs, which has just been translated by
Howard.
Garlic
Ballads was it actually 89? If not, it was hot, like, on the heels of that.
So Republic
of
Wine.
It was his second novel.
Okay. It was fairly short. The Republic of Wine, I think, came out in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. So he's been writing steadily for about 30 years.
Mm. And he's always been a member of the Writers Association.
Well, I don't know when he joined. I'm expecting it to be the 80s when he started publishing in China, right. Writer, People's Literature. He's been published in all the big magazines, and then his books have been very hot sellers. And I think he has this, I guess, short story or novella called The Transparent Carrot that was published in China Writer, which I think in the early mid-80s, and it made his name because it was so experimental at the time.
Yeah.
So he's actually seen as this kind of really experimental writer, but now, of course, he's very much a Writers' Association mainstream.
So, I mean, of course, the whole controversy centers on this question of what responsibilities does he have as a writer to tackle issues of people in the relationship with the state about how should he confront state power? Does he have an obligation to confront state power? But before we get into that issue, let's talk about him and his worthiness as a writer. I mean, Brendan, we were talking the other day, and you said something I thought was pretty funny. You said something to the effect of, you know, there are many valid reasons to dislike him, but his politics aren't one of them. But
yeah,
what are the valid reasons for you? I mean, you're not a fan, right?
I don't think he's a bad writer. Okay. I think he is a very accomplished writer and a very hardworking writer, and he has a lot of skill and a lot of experience writing books that I don't like.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not – it doesn't make him a bad person or a bad writer. He just – he doesn't spin my wheels. My biases are towards classical Chinese, towards, you know, a slightly more cosmopolitan or refined style, something that you see in the nationalist era writers. And that means that Mo Yan just isn't going to do it for me.
Right.
But you say that he's an experimental writer, and he is. If you look at his novels, he's trying something different in every single one of them, either structurally or thematically. I think he works a lot harder than most of his contemporaries. I happen not to like what he does with it, but I don't think he's a lazy writer. I don't think he's untalented.
No, he wrote his latest book in like 42 days or something.
Right. Well, that doesn't work in
that's
his
not
favor.
Lazy, at least.
That doesn't work in his favor. You know, I mean, he could have edited.
It wasn't Jack Kerouac doing
doing lines
on the road.
Right. And to be fair, you can tell he wrote his book in 42 days.
Yeah.
You can really tell.
Boy, nobody edits.
So who are the sort of points of comparison that people more familiar with, you know, the English language literature might want to sort of compare him to?
Well, Anglophone literature, I mean, García Márquez.
I mean, it's stuff that we're familiar with in translation.
That's certainly one of them, because in the 80s, 100 Years of Solitude, and those books were just absolutely the intelligentsia's,
And
Cat's Meow, and it was translated into several translations. And he must have read all that stuff.
Certainly.
Absorbed that completely.
Faulkner.
Right.
And, you know, earlier than that, I think he's named Gogol as one of his influences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
So psychological, stream of consciousness is a big part of it, this magical realism. Realistic passages melding into dreamlike things.
Yeah. And switching of narrative
right.
voices. So from, you know, he's and she's, you don't really know who's
right.
thinking or speaking.
I've often found that the criticisms of him, who was this woman?
Anna Sun.
Who said, you know, it was a hodgepodge of different registers and everything.
Oh, I hated that essay.
I mean,
let's talk about that essay.
To me, that's just postmodernism. You know, he's just trying to do what was in the air.
What everyone else
has
been
doing. Right. Everyone's doing that, right?
Yeah, well, boy, Anna Sun's essay. Again, I am with her in not particularly liking what Mo Yan does. But that's
not the criticism.
Well, her criticism boiled down to Mo Yan is not Eileen Chang. And the position was taken by a bougie Shanghainese chick. There was only going to be one Eileen Chang.
And also saying that Eileen Chang probably doesn't want to be Eileen Chang the way that you are characterizing her right now.
Yeah.
Well, let's actually make succinctly what is it that Anna Sun argues? She says that his language is diseased, that it's essentially so infected by the rhetorical style of the Chinese Communist Party that it's been Maoified, that it's infused with this sort of party speak.
And that's fair.
Okay.
To an extent.
But she also brings in Yu Hua and Su Tong and says that all of this, whole generation of post-50s writers are all diseased.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a big generalization.
And also says it's lost the link to the classical literature.
Right.
To
influence like Qian Zhongshu and Shen Congwen.
Yeah.
Right?
And I mean, Qian Zhongshu, the one of few really genuinely world-class writers China produced during the 20th century. Qian's my hero. But Qian was born into a literatus household.
Right.
He studied at Tsinghua and Cambridge.
And he wrote all of his stuff before liberation.
And he wrote all of his stuff before the liberation. And after 1949,
he never wrote fiction again.
Right.
Yeah.
Mo Yan was born in the ass end of nowhere in, you know, a real bummer of a century and, you know, just grew up in abject poverty. Of course he is not going to write like somebody who is trained by missionaries and Confucian scholars.
Yeah, I mean, Anna Sun has this quote where she basically says that the novels that Mo Yan and his contemporaries write are like John Grisham, Daniel Steele, and even E.L. James, and have no pretension of being good literature. Did you read this part?
Yeah, I remember that.
It's just like, I have a problem because people like Mo Yan, who, you know, I've met, not really name dropping, but, you know, thank you, Brendan. You know, like, you just know that he's not going to be able to have something to say about this, because one, he knows the translation. If he wants to respond to Anna Sun, he needs to get something translated into English so that her market understands it. And he knows the pitfalls of translation. He knows that everything gets skewered and twisted. So, and also, you know, he's being attacked from all this kind of, you know, Anna Sun and Perry Link, and he probably is so tired of it that he doesn't want to respond anyway. So the fact that we'll never ever hear what Moyen has to think about being compared to E.R. James really bothers me. And the fact is, you know, the E.R. James argument is just so pernicious.
It doesn't hold up on a single front. You know, Mo Yan is viewed, whether people read him or not, he's viewed as a literary writer.
Yeah.
He's not sold at airport bookstores.
No.
And his stuff is not particularly light or easy or enjoyable going.
The book that I most recently read, I haven't finished it, is Zhou Guo, The Wine Country. Yeah. And I found myself, you know, just psychologically being sucked into the accounts, you know, when he's being plied with all this liquor and gets into this. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't put it down. I was just like,
yeah,
because it's very well written.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things is readability. I was talking with Brendan today, and, you know, say what you might, not literary, sort of vulgar and use of speech and you know, not sophisticated, but it's very readable. So, yeah. I mean,
He's got a cinemast's rhythm that keeps surprising you and moving forward. That's not easy to do.
It's oral storytelling.
Yeah. It's like oral storytelling.
Yeah, and he has it. You know, he has the storytelling knack. And in Frogs, the latest one, you know, you don't want to hear about how, you know, a fictionalized aunt who works as an abortionist. Because she has to, you know, implement the one-child policy in her village. And this aunt is this huge demon of a woman who makes women have abortions at 7 months, and the narrator's wife is being pushed in the same direction as the women that he's seen his aunt basically, you know, drive to madness. I mean, who wouldn't want to read that kind of thing? It's great. It's great storytelling. Yeah. So that's not really an E.R. James.
I mean, it hardly seems mild and uncritical either, I mean, which is often the rub. I mean, which is the you know,
that was
the most common criticism.
That was the thing that really drove me bug shit. Was the notion that Mo was a patsy. I think patsy was the word Salman Rushdie used.
Yeah, Rushdie actually used the word patsy.
Salman Rushdie could not point to China on a map of China. And I guarantee you he has not read Mo Yan. And if you read a single one of his books, whether it's Red Sorghum, in which I believe the communist leader is repeatedly referred to as a bandit, whether it's the Garlic Ballads, which was banned for a time, and it's about basically official corruption at the village level and the human toll that it takes on farmers who are powerless to resist.
Yeah.
Read The Republic of Wine, right, where you have a monstrously corrupt, fictionalized province where they have these banquets where the centerpiece is braised baby.
Right. Whether it is or not. But exactly.
A lot of it's violent. It's, you know, sexually depressing. It's very, very, I know, sometimes it's about eating babies or, I guess, aborting babies. I mean, it's not.
But I think we're into the political thing.
Sure, we wandered in.
I mean, I think if people that I suppose anyone who's listening by now must really be fans of Mo Yan, they would have turned off long ago. So
right.
We can get right into the geekiness. But I mean, the issue of the political thing is it's unfair to call him a patsy. Absolutely. The problem is, where exactly does it lie? And I think it has a lot to do with how we think of the Nobel Prize.
Right.
That's the problem. It's if you think of it as, oh, it has literally nothing to do with politics. We're just merely evaluating. That's ridiculous. It has everything to do with politics.
Right.
That's why the criticisms came up. It's a political prize.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could win it according to the Nobel Committee because, in fact, Nguyen is has a dissident sort of flavor and status to him. The problem is he's working in that fine line that all artists have to do if they want to work in China. Which is, and Liao Yiwu does it. You know, you get arrested, then you're out again. Mm-hmm. Ai Weiwei skirts the line. He's, you know,
Ai Weiwei has a magic daddy. Some people go way over
the line and then end up in jail.
Yeah.
Mo Yan doesn't want to end up in jail, but he's still writing, you know, critical stuff, mm-hmm. right? So now the question is, if it's a political prize, then, well, if you're not in jail, then you don't deserve it, right? You must be sucking up to the government. Why aren't you in jail?
Yeah.
And this is sort of the crux of the whole thing, and then the criticisms. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very subtle. There's two ways of looking at it. I don't see what you guys think about it, but you know, I think it's fair if you're conceptualizing the prize in that way to at least address that. Mm-hmm. And that's what Perry Link does. I mean, he's not saying that Moyen shouldn't write that way or he shouldn't skirt that line. He's just simply saying, let's make a distinction between, you know, the really serious, the ones that do not compromise their values, like Garcia Boa, mm-hmm. and Moyen, who is playing a little game, you know.
But what's the alternative? If you're looking at Chinese writers mm-hmm. who are still alive, which narrows it way the hell down, what's the alternative? Who would you give the prize?
Well, actually, I mean, Perry Link does address this. I mean, in that piece that ran in Chinaphile in an abridged version.
Read it so I can smash it. Read it so
I
can smash it.
I mean, so you know, first of all, he tries to answer this question after Charles Laughlin puts it to him. He doesn't, in his first iteration of this, he doesn't really answer the question. It was a title that his editors put on. Does Moyen deserve the Nobel Prize? And his answer to it is no. And here's what he says. He says, no, the answer is no. Moyen would not have been at the top of my list. For authenticity and control of language, I would rate Zhong Acheng, Jia Pinghua, Wang Anyi, Liao Yu, and Wang Shuo more highly. For mastery of the craft of fiction, Bai Xianyong and Ha Jin are clearly superior to Moyen. For breadth of spiritual vision, Zheng Yi is one of my favorites. I would also have put Yu Hua or Jin Yong, the Hong Kong writer of popular historical martial arts fiction, above Moyen. But those are only my views. Please help yourself to your own. And so help yourself to your own. No, mm-hmm. yeah. First of all, that list.
First off, there are some fine writers on that list.
Many of them are dead.
Many of them are from Hong Kong. Or
dead or creatively dead. Zhong Acheng, who wrote the King of Chess, the King of Children, the King of Trees. Outstanding. Some of the best stuff you will ever read about the Cultural Revolution. Has not written fiction since the early 90s.
Right.
He writes exclusively for film and TV. Now, you can argue that that's because it's very hard to write good fiction in China, maybe. But
and Wang Shuo as well.
Wang Shuo has been a Nobel Prize?
I would love to see that just, you know, as an expression of support for the vernacular.
Show up to the ceremony drunk, you know.
I mean, basically, Wang Shuo is a Feng Xiaogang film, right? Feng Xiaogang now writes like Wang Shuo and then makes films. So, I mean, Wang Shuo used to write for Feng Xiaogang, and basically all of those, you know, Jia Fang, Yi Fang, and all of the films,
Mei Lan
Mei Liao, all those amazing films, they were basically like either because of Wang Shuo or Feng Xiaogang started copying Wang Shuo.
Right, inspired by his style.
So, yeah, great style. Stylist up
stylist,
there.
Stylist, yeah, sure.
But probably just commercial, very commercial.
Ha Jin, obviously,
he doesn't count as a Chinese writer.
Right, it was so goddamn soporific. I tried reading, waiting.
No, I like Ha Jin, but he's not a Chinese writer.
He writes in Chinese.
What's interesting to know about him is that he claims that he chooses to write in English precisely because of this diseased language notion.
Yeah.
He says, I don't want to be writing in this polluted language, and so he wants. But, you know, I mean, I'm not sure I believe that. But, I mean,
back on to polluted language. I remember one thing that I really objected to in Perry Link's piece was when he kind of did his recapitulation of the Anisuin argument and cited a few examples of what he thought were polluted language. And mm-hmm. Brent and I were talking about this the other night. There's one phrase he objects to when he says, you know, he overhears a woman on a long bus trip whose daughter is saying that she needs to pee really badly. And she says to her, Gentry.
Yeah. Boy, I have a lot of respect for Perry Link, but that was an unbelievably stupid argument. Gentry means hold on.
Right.
That's all it means. And
I can't see any other meaning. What is it meant to be politicized as?
Because it turns up on Cultural Revolution era slogans. You know, we've got to hold on in the fight against Soviet revisionism.
That's ridiculous. Jianshi was used pre-1949.
It's just a small
point. No, but I mean, there are plenty of words he might have used that you know, his other example is, you know, he said of people who were sitting around a banquet table and everyone was saying, you know, let's finish the food. Let's annihilate it. Xiao mie.
That's a joking use.
Right, exactly. I mean, I use that sort of, you know, commie talk all the time just in a joking sense.
Mm-hmm. I never realized when I said let's show me this food with my friends, I was actually saying let's go and kill all the foreign devils in the land. You know, like in current usage, no one thinks of it as revolutionary.
Yeah.
Even if you're born after 1950.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Link, I don't know if he's just been barred examples. From China for too long or what.
In my recommendations, I'm going to recommend something about him, so I'll stick up for it. I mean, you could take issue with some examples, but I mean, he has some valid points about it. I mean, you're not denying the fact that the Chinese language now is...
crap, yeah.
No, yeah, it has been distorted, polluted by these usages that the ghosts of these semantics that people can't do away with.
Sure, just there are plenty of things in American parlance that really bother me. I mean, war on terror.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like that's the level of stuff we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You can say, well, these are not good examples, but I mean, the examples are legion. You just have to think of where they are. But and that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. These writers fall into this. Mm-hmm. They're tropes sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're just a word that has a certain semantic meaning, or they say buy into certain stereotypes or certain defaults.
But that's like saying let's ignore literature written after 1949 because that whole period, the last 64 years, does not count in Chinese literature. Let's only like writers who wrote. You know, I love Shen Congwen, I love Qian Zhongshu, I love all these writers, but I'm not going to say I'm going to ignore everyone else.
I'm done with that.
Yeah, right. Then anyway, I'm doing this to be contrarian to you. But,
anyway, there are two more things that I want to do before we go to recommendations. One of them is to talk about the Der Spiegel interview that he did. The other I'd like to do to talk about his actual Stockholm speech, the parables that he told, and see if we can maybe dissect those. So let's talk first about the Der Spiegel interview, which was the first interview that he's given since the Nobel Prize was awarded. Do you think that he acquitted himself well there? Brendan, let's start with you.
Mo Yan has obviously not had media training, right? You saw that when he arrived in Stockholm. You saw that in a big way when he arrived in Stockholm. With the Der Spiegel interview, I think he will probably not be granting any more interviews to foreign journalists. I think he actually did acquit himself very well, and I think that the headline is deeply unfair. The headline is...
Let's remind people what the headline is. It says...
I am guilty.
Mo Yan, comma, I am guilty.
Right. Which is taken utterly out of context.
Yes.
Mo Yan is... I mean, in this interview, I think he comes about as close as he's ever going to come to saying outright that he is, like everybody else attempting to create art in China, he's compromised. Mm-hmm. And he makes as few compromises as possible in order to maintain some balance between artistic integrity and not getting his ass locked up or not getting banned or whatever.
That this should come as a shock to anyone is astonishing to me these days. I mean,
you forgot at the start of this podcast, you forgot to require us all to express support for Liu Xiaobo. And the thing is that, I mean, Liu Xiaobo shouldn't be in jail. And, you know, Charter 08 is a harmless, mostly useless document, and it's stupid that anybody should be locked up for that. But outside China, this is viewed as a binary choice.
Right.
If you like Mo Yan, then you must be okay with Liu Xia being under house arrest.
Liu Xiaobo being under
arrest. No, Liu Xiaobo is under arrest.
Right. But is his wife, right?
Yeah.
Liu Xia.
Right.
Alice, what did you think of the Der Spiegel interview?
Actually, I often have a different opinion. I don't know why this is, but with Eric and Brendan, all my colleagues and people I work with. But I mean, I actually thought that it was a good interview, partly because the guy doesn't say many words. You know, every answer is only three lines and he gets to the point. And he hasn't answered questions previously about all these attacks, including Ai Weiwei attacks on him, and you know, every time that the Spiegel interviewer says, "Have you heard what the attacks are?" and the guy's like, "No, what is it?" and then the guy's like, "They say they accuse you of this," and then Mo Yan kind of thinks about it, and then says, "Oh," and he gives you an answer, and I find that very liberating. At least the guy has a chance to know exactly what has been said about him, because I don't think he reads the Guardian, the New York Times, where Ai Weiwei is published, because Ai Weiwei is not published inside China, right? Which, of course, we would like to change, but the reality is he's not. So Mo Yan being able to say that is great. And I think that, you know, it's genuine that when he agreed to a very short interview, it ended up being 2 hours, the interview, which is in the preface to the article, which is really nice. I think that Mo Yan likes to sit down and maybe you could have a conversation with him about it. And he would tell you. And obviously, he says, you know, the Rights Association stuff that I do is he's basically implies it's just a job. He has to go up and make speeches, and he has to go and become, you know, this official, and he has to
copy out the
copy out. Yeah, he said the Yan thing. He was like, yeah, some dude came up to me at this conference and said, "Hey, Mr. Mo, or Guan, I guess, whatever, can you please copy out a passage from this Mao speech?" And Mo Yan was like, "Sure, why not?" And he does it. And then now the vitriol against the guy is just like amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. To be fair, there are writers and in fact high-ranking members of the Writers Association who refused to copy out the speech and nothing came of it.
Yeah, I think to me I thought the interview was just him being caught where he is. It's a very uncomfortable position.
Mm-hmm. And it's what so many people are familiar with. Yeah,
I sympathize with him because mea culpa. I do this all the time. I mean, when I see him squirming, I think, you know, if they interviewed me, I do all kinds of compromising, icky things in order to keep existing in this place. You know, tell little white lies or say, oh, yeah, that's really great. Or, you know, you go on a TV show and they ask you a question and, of course, you're not going to say exactly what you think you're going to say.
Those islands are definitely Chinese.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he's made a decision to walk that line, and he wants to just write. He's a writer. He doesn't want to be fighting these fights, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes to these things, and he's in this environment. Suddenly, little decisions like, yeah, that was a good description. You know, write out this talk of Yan'an, you know, Mao's Yan'an talks, you know. It's this act of obsequious sellout, right?
Right.
But in the context, it wasn't. It was par for the course. This
right.
is what happens all the time. And you just
exactly.
do it, and it's no big deal at that point.
Right.
But in retrospect, someone can go back,
yeah.
take it out of context and say, you know, look at that.
And
so I just felt very sorry for him because
yeah.
he's just saying, come on, leave me alone. I won the Nobel Prize. Let me just keep writing. And he is writing stuff. He's trying. He is critical, and he's making so, you know, his novels are always critical of some aspect of Chinese society. Give
yeah.
him a break. I mean, that's the idea.
You know, one thing about being critical, I think it was part of Perry Link's criticism of Mo, that he doesn't criticize the structure. I think that would be a valid criticism if Mo were not a literary author. Unfortunately, he's writing fiction. I thought, Link's thing revealed a lack of clarity on the fiction-nonfiction dichotomy. But, you know, Mo is coming from the village level. He
right.
writes about stuff that happens at the village level. He is not going to write a critique of the party.
And everything he writes doesn't need to be a microcosmic vehicle from which to expound.
Let me just defend yeah. Perry Link for a second, though,
sure.
because I think if you're saying, look, you make choices in this world, and here's this thing, here's a guy, he has an audience, and he's writing about this topic, and it's the Great Leap Forward, let's say, as he talks about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can make a choice. You can say, you know, I'm going to skirt this line, and I'm going to approach it with satire, you know, what he
right.
calls daft hilarity or something like that. If you are in the mindset where you're thinking, this is a chance to really, you know, make a great effect on the readership and make them realize something, then you're saying you're faced with this choice. And you're thinking, all right, this is a very important sort of event. You are, in a certain sense, deflecting the attention because the people reading that may not even know, in fact, what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you're missing a chance there. It's not saying, you know, you shouldn't write like that or there should be no such writers. He's
right.
saying, given the choice, you know, this is not funny. This is like serious stuff. And if everything you approach like that is like, you know, satire, I'll approach all these events, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, it's all satire,
yeah.
then what's the point? You know, it's
yeah.
not that you have to write a documentary instead of fiction, but just somehow you have to be responsible to the moral import of what you're writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, if you're looking at it that way, I can totally see Perry Link's point.
He's
saying, you came down on that side, okay, all well and good, more power to you, make your money, get your Nobel Prize. I don't respect that. That's
mm-hmm.
why he didn't say, you know, that Mo Yan should be castigated for that. He just said, when it comes right down to it, that's not my cup of tea. I don't respect that. I would have chosen anyone but him. That's a reasonable, it's reasonable.
Yeah, sure. And I don't think Perry Link is dumb.
No.
He's extremely smart.
Yeah.
He knows a hell of a lot about his subject. But he's criticizing Mo Yan for not being somebody other than Mo Yan.
Well,
basically.
I mean, do you think Perry Link has
yeah.
read the critical novels of Mo Yan?
I'm sure he has. I'm sure he's
okay.
Yeah.
Well, we can go
mean,
on with this for a little while. Let's, why don't we do one? I think in a good illustration of the way that he does ride that fine line is in the parables
yeah.
that he gave it to Ed Stockholm. Do we want to pick a couple of these and then sort of recapitulate what they said and what your interpretation is of what they meant? Brendan, you're nodding.
I think the parables are presented in the order they're presented for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember what the first one is.
The first one is.
Oh, have you got them
there?
I
have it. We've reprinted the entire speech, courtesy of the Nobel Foundation 2012. So, you want the first one, right?
Yeah, a couple of lines so we can recall which one.
This is the mandatory crying, right?
Oh, right, yeah. When I was a third grade student in the 1960s, my school organized a field trip to an exhibit of suffering where, under the direction of our teacher, we cried bitter tears. Mm-hmm. That one.
Right. So there's that. Then that's followed by a story from his time as a young soldier. Right?
Soldier, when an LD officer opens the door and comes in and says, "Where is everyone?" And Moyen stands up and says, "Are you saying I'm no one?" Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then finally, there's the parable of the men in the temple. Mm-hmm. And they decide that they run into a temple to shelter from a storm. The storm continues while they're in the temple. They realize that one of them has to be sacrificed in order for the storm to abate. They cast one member out of the temple and
the temple collapses.
The temple collapses on them. Everyone inside dies, right. And they get their comeuppance.
Okay.
But they flung a guy out first.
What do they mean? What do these mean? Take a crack.
Oh, I thought Brendan had a nugget of wisdom about the order they came in.
The first one is him clearly saying, like, I am not going to do what is expected of me.
Okay.
Whether or not that is expressing support for Liu Xiaobo, you can read that yourself. The second one is him telling the story about a time when he reacted sharply, but then later felt remorse about his
right.
response. Right? Mm-hmm. Where is everybody? I'm not somebody, but later I regretted having said that. This is calling, I think he's calling himself into question.
Right.
And
that's
finally,
my interpretation too.
You know, and then finally you have the parable of the temple, which has been interpreted by some people as a parable of the Communist Party. Not sure if I buy that.
Well, I think they all are about the individual's relationship with the state. I think that the teacher in the first one clearly, you know, stands for state authority, you know, directing you at an emotional level, telling you, we need to cry here. I mean, it's about patriotic education. It's about how we are expected to interpret history and how he stands apart from that. That second one is as you say, I mean, where that sort of egoistic act can go too far. One can take that sort of act of egoism to a regrettable extreme. Mm-hmm. And the third, I think, is sort of a more straightforward I don't know. It was straightforward when I heard it.
Yeah, but I think it's
quite
actually
a parable.
Right.
Well, I think it's a measure of his skill as a writer that he's able to construct these three compact, very like polyvalent stories. You know, you can read whatever you want into them.
Good word, Brendan. Polyvalent.
I try.
Did no one see the kind of the online someone was writing online that the second parable is about the empty chair at Liu Xiaobo's?
That was A.E. Clark, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Though there's the interpretation that the old guy comes in and he glanced in the seat in front of me.
Yeah.
Huh. Which was empty. The seat was, and then he said, "Where is everyone?" Because it's empty seats.
That's
a nice response.
Well, let's leave the mystery to our listeners and leave them to their own interpretations and move on to the section where we make recommendations. Why don't we start with David?
Okay. Well, as long as we're doing Perry Link all day, every day. He's got a new book out. It's called An Anatomy of Chinese that, in fact, touches upon some of the things we've talked about in this podcast. It's divided into three parts. The first is rhythm, and it touches upon aspects of Chinese such as prosody and symmetry, mm-hmm. and slogans, and all, you know, sorts of public announcements and this kind of stuff. And it sets the tone for, you know, how the Chinese language uses these prosodic elements and stuff to sort of create tone political, or not necessarily political, but certainly register and tone.
Right.
You know, it's very unique as a language in that
sure.
in that sense, right? Because of the syllabic nature of the language and stuff like that. So he talks about that. That's very fun, very interesting. The next section is called metaphor. And it's a very sort of a cognitive analysis for the way that metaphor works in Chinese, the sorts of deep structures of the language, the sorts of images that Chinese uses to create meaning. And so it has a little bit of very cognitive flavor. He talks about, you know, metaphor systems. He talks about George Lakoff,
mm-hmm.
that we've talked about, the metaphor systems, and how they're used in politics. Like you just mentioned, the war on terror and this kind of thing,
sure.
right? And it makes a sort of Worfian case a little bit. I mean, it's very interesting. It's one of the best expositions of all of that research that's been done. And the last section brings it all together, and he talks about politics and the way that language is used in politics, the way that, you know, politics can affect language, and then language can also, you know, affect politics.
Well,
and he has lots of case examples and stuff.
This is great.
It's really a really very carefully worked out with, and the main thing, lots of amazing examples. You know, don't judge him by these two examples that you found fault with, because he's got a lot of examples and he makes a very good case. And of course you can always argue you have better ones or worse ones, you know, but it's a great read, and I think it's eye-opening even for the people who are really good at Chinese and have thought about things for a long time. I guarantee you there'll be insights in there that you've never thought of before, and he lays them out very well. It's called Anatomy of Chinese. Great book.
Thanks, awesome. Dude. That's awesome. I will definitely read that. Alice, what do you have for us?
All right. Well, I was going to say the Bookworm Literary Festival, but I don't know when the podcast goes out.
It'll be out on Friday, so it is going on. It'll still be happening.
So on Saturday, come see me. I'm joking. Actually, no. There is a writer called Ren Xiaowen from Shanghai who's in her 30s, who I think is one of the best writers writing now. And, you know, we don't all need to be stuck with disease language now that the market has opened up and newer writers are trying to pitch in their voices. So go to the Bookworm, I think on the same day, on Saturday, Eric Abrahamson is doing a talk with Liu Zhenyun, who's another Beijing-based writer, very established, similar to Wang Shuo, and is a fantastic heavyweight of this year at the Bookworm Festival, so Saturday at the Bookworm. Similarly, I want to recommend another Beijing-based thing, which is one of our translator friends, Cindy Carter's translation of Ye Liangke's Dream of Ding Village, which I keep going on about. I think I recommended it for the Wall Street Journal blog as well, because she is a great translator. She's someone who's been in China for, you know, 10 odd years, and then Japan before that, works on her language fantastically. And Ye Liangke, obviously we all know that it's an AIDS book, so it was banned in China, so that should please some people. And, you know, it's a really good book as well, and very worthy at the same time as, I guess, enjoyable, though characterization isn't really the Chinese novelist's strong point.
God knows.
Thank you. Brendan, what do you have for us?
Boy, if you read Chinese, Guaren by Ai Yi is really good.
It's by who? I'm sorry.
Ai Yi. It's a bunch of things.
I have an Ai Yi at home. She wrote a book.
Different
Ai Yi.
But these were adapted from blog posts. They're a bunch of short, almost dreamlike, weird little stories. Ai's really promising, I think. Feng Tang, another young writer, great ear for dialogue. Neither of these guys is available in English yet.
No, sadly.
If you want to read something in English, Yuhua, who was recommended by Perry Link.
China in 10 Words.
China in 10 Words, beautifully
great
translated
book.
By Alan Barr.
Reading
and,
it right now.
It's just, it's the best thing Yuhua's written in years.
It is.
It's very good.
The translation is lovely.
Yeah.
And and even if you're a China nerd, you'll learn something from it, or you'll get stories that you can steal and misappropriate. Yeah. And, you know, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to recommend the Connected China site by Reuters, connectedchina.reuters.com. I don't know if I think a lot of people have already passed this around on various social media, but it's sort of a tablet optimized site that is physical. I mean, it's graphically just gorgeous, and it's quite deep. And not only can you find links off of it to all the current crop of Reuters stories, Reuters reporting on China, but also a lot of infographics. And one of the most, I mean, probably the most talked about part of it is sort of this illustration of the networks of relationships between and among the party elite, specifically the members of the Politburo Standing Committee. And it's very well done. Very
you can only do with that sort of.
You can only do that.
It's
that kind
the
of
only way you could present that.
Right. I mean, as I think, was it you that said this is what the internet was made for, David?
That's
Yeah.
You got to give them the URL or the. Yeah.
I did. I said connectedchina.reuters.com. Okay. Yeah. Cool. So definitely check that out. It's a very, very valuable resource. So thanks, guys. Thanks, Alice.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Thanks, David and Brendan.
Yeah.
We have sad news, though. I mean, Brendan, happy and sad news at once. Brendan has been accepted to a couple of graduate programs at Stanford and at
UPenn. I'm going to Penn.
You've decided, you've already told Penn you're going. Okay, so you're going to get the fuck out of
No, but I've got plans. I'm going to kidnap Brendan and put him in a dungeon So this is a call out to Seneca listeners. We're looking for a Brendan lookalike. We can send to Penn.
You know, you guys and
doesn't have to be smart.
Pop-Up
but he has
Chinese
look like
is
Brendan.
Looking for a Brendan soundalike. So maybe you guys can.
Oh, I think maybe I can do that. No. Maybe I could take your job.
Yeah, let's just talk really quietly.
Talks more like this.
Nothing like Brendan.
Okay. Anyway, thanks,
we're gonna
guys.
All imitate Brendan now.
We'll see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care. Bye bye.